Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are, and it is a rainy, blessedly rainy day, and even a week of rain and fog and sleet and semi-snow and all kinds of stuff like that. So it is dark, it is gloomy, it is dreary, and it is awesome. Okay, so get used to saying that, ladies and gentlemen. Get used to saying when it rains in Israel, it's awesome. That's the way we think about it out here. We all drive through the rain and through the puddles and all that and just say, Baruch Hashem. Speaking of Baruch Hashem, shalom to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom.
Oh, shalom, Yishai.
So great to be with you here at the Pardes Institute, which I love being at. Just a very lively place. It's just a lot of fun to come into Yerushalayim and to come to Pardes. There was hot choco that was being served upstairs, and then they started singing...
Let the temple be rebuilt.
Let the temple be rebuilt.
Which, the irony of which is that I'm sure most of my students actually don't know what that phrase means.
Right, and they may be shocked that they were singing it. but in any case, it was
a catchy tune.
It's a catchy tune, and it's good words. So that's a lot of fun. And also, shalom and welcome to the Land of Israel Network. Such an honor and a pleasure to be on a radio conglomerate that really gets audio podcasting conglomerate that gets out great shows. And I was just at Ben Bresky's house, and I saw Gil Hoffman left all these newspapers there. And I knew the Gil had been there. The Gil had been in town.
The mark of the Gil.
The Gil. Gil was here, and he's doing great stuff as usual. And so the rest of our folks, including, for example, Rabbi Shlomo Katz, who, like, you just see stuff on video and different things. And, like, it's so funny. Like, once you're, like, in the like, today... The internet world will, like, remind you of things. It will
feed you. Remember,
it'll feed you. Yeah.
Yes, I know you like this.
Yeah, you've looked at it once before.
We've only begun to touch the edges of that. Once right. artificial intelligence really comes online, you're going to be presented with things that actually I think you would like this.
Right.
As opposed to just I have a consistent pattern.
Right. Well, they have that, like, in all these Pandora, the music, like, you feel right. like that. Yeah, we think you might like
try
that.
This, yeah, but it's right. beyond association. There's another level coming.
Like on YouTube, for example, I have all these subscriptions. When I go to YouTube, it never shows me my subscriptions until I hit subscriptions. I'm like, no, YouTube, I've already told you that's what I want.
That's what I want, right.
Stop trying to feed me something else. And they also, like, some of the complaint today about the internet is that they really, like, the best engineers in the world are spending time just thinking about how to keep you on Facebook.
Yes.
That is their, like, great...
Hold your attention.
Right, hold your attention, which means basically how to enslave you, how to capture you.
Oh, the human brain has been hacked. At this point, you have been hacked, people. And,
wow.
And
my brain's been hacked.
If you're not aware of that, then you don't realize the danger there, because who holds the power in that system, right? It's a worthwhile question, though perhaps not one for right now.
Mm. Somehow, though, it does tie into our Torah portion, which is the Parshat Bo, and I kind of was already laughing at myself for pre-saying this, which is I realized that actually Parshat Bo is a very revolutionary Torah portion in terms of Torah portions in a few different ways. Like, there are evolutions or revolutions that are going to happen, and I wrote down three major ones that I found in this week's Torah portion, and one of them has really something to do with this greater question, which I don't think I ever studied this in college or anybody ever told me, but the questions of identity and narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Today, these are big words.
Sure.
But they weren't so much back then. But I realized that the Torah is very, very concerned with narrative.
Absolutely.
Very concerned with narrative. For example, Maharat HaMachpelah, I started realizing, okay, the narrative is telling me, tell over the narrative.
Yes.
Okay? And now I realize that, like, as we're going to be exodusing,
Leaving town.
Yeah, I think exodusing is good, you know, to exodus.
To exide.
All right. As we're leaving Egypt, the Torah is going to be very concerned about how is this going to be kept. Like just as a concept, let's just think about that as a concept. Like, we're going to have a big old moment right now, but right now I'm putting implicit in the big old moment now that we're going to be remembering this forever. And I want you to, at this moment when it's happening, remember that we're going to be remembering it.
Yes, and what it speaks to is this deep question, which is embedded in the whole Torah, whether the real power of change resides in events or in how their story is told, right? And I believe that the Torah is very clear, and our Parsha is one of the central proofs for it, that the real power in the world is how the story of events are told. I mean, not that the, you know, that the 10 plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea and even Sinai were not earth-shattering events in and of themselves, but if you're looking for the impact in the events themselves, then you're limiting the sort of capacity for change.
Right.
And that's why God says, "V'higarta levincha," right? When your children ask, because they're going to, how, like, what happened? Like, what was that about? You need to be ready to frame your experience in a way in which is going to sort of propagate through time the growthful message that's embedded in it. Otherwise, experiences can, you know, can be translated into all kinds of different narratives.
Right.
So, and this is the art form of Torah in general.
My wife is involved in this thing. She's a doula, mm-hmm. a birth coach, mm-hmm. but she's like, the birth moment has to be meaningful in such a way that you will reflect back on it and be like, that was an awesome experience.
Yes.
And something happened that was good and amazing and spiritual growth, instead of...
That was horrific. I'm glad I survived it.
Right. And like, okay, you know what I mean?
Like,
that was
medical procedure. Let's move on. Now I got
right,
the baby.
Right. Now I have to raise this child. No. Like, have this moment.
This, by the way, goes a long way to explaining why, at least we as a culture, and I believe that the non-Jewish world as well, put such a heavy emphasis on the wedding ceremony. Right, meaning, you know, there's a like, it comes up all the time. I'm at the stage where many of my friends are starting to marry off their first children, and the question always comes up: really, do you really want me to spend that kind of money on your wedding? What if I gave you the money I would spend in your wedding in a lump sum? You might be able to put it down as a down payment on an apartment, for goodness sake, depending on where you are and what's happening. And almost universally, the answer is no. Like this moment is important to me. Why? Because it's a framing moment for the life you're going to live. And so it's very critical that it be what it is a person dreams that it be.
Mm-hmm. You have to be very conscious of that, because let's say I'm a slave in Egypt and there's plagues all around me and I'm getting rushed out and stuff. I'm not sure that I have the presence of mind to consider how this is going to be for perpetuity. That generation, let's just put ourselves in the shoes of that generation who are in the moment, and they have been slaves, and they really are escaping this dangerous foe, this dangerous oppressor, and also hearing the voice of an invisible God and going to the desert, etc. This is not a moment exactly to be like, okay, a wedding is an event that is not a kind of cataclysmic event. It's well planned. You know about it. You understand it, and you've seen it be normal.
And nevertheless, most people in the moment, you know, you see. I think I always encourage my students, like, you just have to be present in the moment. Let yourself go into it. Don't think about.
Mm-hmm.
Just be.
Right, but then but we're talking about thinking about.
So, well, no, you have to set the stage, and because I actually want to make a distinction here. One of the great American authors, Wallace Stegner. Don't know if you've ever read it. A very powerful book called Angle of Repose. And in it, he posits an idea that he calls the Doppler effect of time. You know what the Doppler effect is in sound? It's as something approaches you, right? The sort of the pitch of sound goes up because, you know, the waves compress, et cetera, and the amplitude and wavelength. And as it passes, sound lengthens. That's why, you know, it's the wee 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 of the siren. So he points out, as events approach you in time, they compress. And they become, and there's a danger of them being incomprehensible. But you know, as you're experiencing, that they will pass you in an instant. So you have to prepare yourself to receive in real time that which will pass you, that you can then begin to understand. So there's a very sort of like fine line. It's true, God says to Moshe, "V'higarta levincha," you're going to have to tell your kids about this. But you're not going to be able to tell them about it if you don't let yourself experience it. At the same time, if you're too immersed in the immediacy of the experience, you don't understand that there's also a narrative happening, so you won't be able to communicate it. And so there's that sort of very sweet spot. And by the by, we live in that same situation today.
Yes.
You know, we live in a situation
That's
today
a point.
Where the events that are coming at us right now, you know, are historic.
It's funny you say that, because just today as I was driving in to meet you here, I listened to the news. Pretty much if I'm in the car and it's on the hour, I like will turn it to the news, as a good Israeli does, okay? And I thought to myself, listening to the news, the whole news cycle was today responding to some statements by the Shabak, the GSS, the security services, that hackers from various countries may try to influence our
I just want to know who they're voting for. I don't care.
The answer is, by the way, and this was the correct answer that I heard. I knew the answer. People were asking, who are they trying to hack in favor?
Right.
And I knew the answer.
What's the answer?
But most people, until I finally spoke to some expert who actually said it correctly, which is, that is not the point. They're not trying to...
They're trying to undermine the integrity of the system.
Exactly.
That makes much more sense.
Right. That's what they're looking for. They're not looking to get one guy or another.
I'm not voting for BB.
It's not BB or not BB. It doesn't matter. It's to confuse you to
undermine faith in the system, right. For sure.
And as I heard on YouTube from a former KGB officer, who said, subvert everything.
Yeah.
That's basically what they believe in. But anyway, I was listening to this. Why am I telling this? Because I was listening to you, and I knew I was coming to meet with you today, and I thought to myself, here we are going to be talking about Torah, and I'm listening to the news of the State of Israel, and my filter tells me this is bunk. This is not important. This is just, you know, it's not really, really happening.
It's tomorrow's fish wrappers.
Right. It's just stuff that the food producers, and I mean the media consumption producers,
the talking heads,
the stuff that they just want you again to listen to them.
Right.
This is a non-story. It's not really real. It's not important. It's just today's thingamabob.
Right.
Right. And I was just like, but we're going to be talking. I'll be talking with Rabbi Mike about Torah, which is trying to tell us a deep trend, a deep story.
Yep.
Underneath it all. So, you know, again, communication is very important, but there's so much white noise out there today.
Well, and so one of the big challenges,
like, somebody's listening to our show today. I'll let you mm-hmm. go right there. Like, somebody's listening to our show today. Are they listening to a Torah show, or is this the news?
Right.
Is this the news show?
Well, and I think what drives you and I both is the answer is yes. Meaning there is a way that you can push through the white noise of our day and try to access what is the story that's actually unfolding
right here.
And that's why you and I both in our own ways are fighting that, as you so nicely call it, that narrative battle.
Right.
Right? Because that's the real field of play.
I learned a new word this week. Joshua Berman is a professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan, came to speak at Efrat.
Mm-hmm.
I got to hear him speak. Very interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting stuff. The whole topic was about biblical criticism,
uh-huh.
about P and non-P,
sure.
and that whole business.
PJD.
Right. He was not talking about the four authors. He was talking about the two authors.
The priestly layer and the,
right, and right, the non-priestly yeah. layer.
Sure.
Whatever. It was very interesting, but I learned a new word that I really liked a lot, which is diachronic.
Yes.
Diachronic. Which is diachronic, I think
I've got a little bit of that in yeah, my hip.
Right. Diachronic is really the study about how things progress.
Through time. Yes.
I really like that a lot. I was excited about that word, diachronic.
What excites you about it?
I just like dia, like dia means through.
Right.
I remember who explained to me that dia always means that. It was actually the famous Islamic professor, what was his name, that passed away? Lewis.
Bernard Lewis.
He said, dia is like diarrhea. It goes through. Okay.
You'll never forget that one.
I'll never forget that one. So always you see diachronic through time. Through
right.
time. I don't know. I just liked it. It's part of narrative. You know, it's part of.
No, for sure. But it speaks exactly to our point here, which is that the Exodus can be seen as cataclysmic and a break between history and redemption, right? Or it can be seen as a process which actually exists in time. And the whole point here is that it's both. Right? It is cataclysmic. Right? The idea that God would reach into Egypt and pull a people out
mm-hmm.
is a break with what we know to be history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But at the same time, the reason that God tells Moshe, and now prepare yourself to keep this story alive, is because God wants that very fact, the very idea that God will step into the picture, wants that to be part of history. Wants to be reintroduced into that sort of flow of time. And so here we are. We tell the story every single
right.
year.
Right. And we're also asked to relive it.
Yes.
We're asked to relive it as much as possible. And there obviously comes in there the Seder, the like what, you know, and it becomes it's hard to separate those two. There's the Exodus that we read about, and then there's that thing that we do.
To relive it
and commemorate it. And it's also like when you read the Torah, this Torah portion, which for the first time will lay down law.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to lay down the law. And the main law is, the first real law is, there's a law for the Jewish people back then, which is going to be to paint their lintels
with the blood of the goats.
Bring in the Egyptian god, the goats or the sheep. Bring him into the house, prepare it for 4 days. That's, by the way, where we learn that a potential korban has to be kind of looked
4-day
at.
4-day inspection.
Inspection, okay. You have to do all that, and then not eat any leaven, and prepare the matzahs and all that. And then we're told basically that that's what we're going to be doing later on
for
in our life, right?
That's
what we're going to be doing. Okay. Let's get to the Torah portion first. I can't skip out on this. We're going to deal first with the three last three plagues. Really three,
sure.
Plus one. I forgot what there's a Latin word for the plus one, where it's like a group of three and then plus one, or a group of nine and then plus one.
You're the lawyer. You know the Latin.
No, it's like a biblical Latin term, you know, where it's like, where there's like, or a literary term where it's like, there's like, for example, like in the book of, in the story of, Bilam in Balak,
you have three prophecies and then there's the tail.
And then there's the zipper.
Right.
Okay. And here we have the nine, which are groups of threes, actually. And then there's the last, which is the zipper, which
right,
is going to be...
firstborn.
The firstborn,
definitely
okay?
Firstborn.
Right. So the three that we're going to deal with are all things of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We're going to deal with... So we're going to go to the seventh plague, and that is the plague of the locusts.
Yes.
The locusts. I happen to think, and I don't want to get in trouble here, that I think the locusts are, to some extent... representative of the Jews themselves.
Ooh. Locusts. What do you mean?
Remember, it says that these locusts come and cover the Ein Ha'aretz, which
right.
is exactly what Bilam says.
Where Balak
is going to say, right?
About Am Yisrael coming out of
right.
the wilderness.
And then also, once the locusts go away, they're all gone.
They're gone, just like the Jews are going to be.
Right, they're gonna get out of here. Like, they eat your thing, and then they're going to get out of here.
Just go head on out, right.
Right.
Okay, I hear it.
All right, so, and it's like a message, like, they're going to be gone. They're going to be gone, okay? And they come and eat. The locusts come and eat. Have you ever seen images of locusts?
Mm-hmm, sure. I mean, I've seen the pictures.
It's a scary thing.
Sure, it used to be a major issue in this region, by the way.
Right.
It was like a lot of research done of how do you hold off the plague.
The plague of locusts.
Yeah.
This, in a sense, this is not such a... This plague, the miraculous element, is just the control element.
Yes.
But itself is common.
And we've spoken about the plagues go back and forth with that. One is the God hacking nature, so to speak. Like, it has used that language we were using before and showing how it obeys God's will. And the other one is there's also something beyond your imagination, right? The fire and ice that fall together.
Right, that's outside.
Two messages that are bound up with each other.
Okay, so right now we're at the plague of locusts, which is okay. The control here, I say this every year. I'll say it again this year. That finally, Pharaoh says to Moses and Aaron, like, he says, "Lechu yivdu et Hashem lokechem, go serve Hashem your God." Miva miha holchim. Who exactly is going? He still wants control.
Sure.
He says, "Who exactly is going?"
He still thinks he matters in this story as other than an instrument for the expression of God's name.
It's interesting you say that because actually he will say, okay, go serve it, but don't forget to bless me. One of the explanations of that is that serve me. Meaning to say, and don't forget, you can bless your God and bless me because I'm also
right.
a God.
Yeah. You got to throw a sacrifice in there for me.
Right, because I'm the God. That's right. I'm the Pharaoh. That's right. So I say this every year. It says... look at the Baal HaTurim. It says, "Miva mi olchim amar paro le Moshe, ma atem vakshim kol kach lalechet? What are you so intent on going? V'chi atem svurim likanes la'aretz? We and you think you're going to go to the land of Israel? Because you're not. You're not. Miva mi olchim likanes la'aretz? It's actually only miva mi are going to the land of Israel. Ki kulam yamutu b'amidbar. Everybody's going to die in the desert. Chutz mi Yoshua v'Kalev. Those are the two people that are going to go in. Miva mi olchim begematria Kalev u'binun." Okay, so you're not going, and he's talking to them like, you know, truth to power. It's like power back to truth.
Right.
It's like, you know, you guys, like,
this is not going to work out so well for you.
You're just like me. What are we really about here? We're about the power, and you're not going to get the power. I see in the stars
right.
that you're not going into the land of
Don't
Israel.
Don't waste your time.
Don't waste your time because you're not going to be the leaders. Says back Moshe Rabbein, according to this, Shiva Moshe benarenu v'skenenu nelech. We'll go with our young people and our old people. The final edict against the Jews that's going to come out in the wake of the sin of the spies is only for people between 20 and 60, not under 20 and not over 60. That's what he answers. We'll go with our young and our old. So that's a little interesting thing that happens there. Anyway, so there's the There's the first the seventh plague we're going to deal with is the plague of the locusts. That's coming out of the sky, okay? And the next one is going to be the arbe.
No, that is locusts.
No. Okay, wait. That's the locusts. So then the next one is going to be the plague of... So, oh, sorry, let me correct that. There's a triad here, and the triad is the hail.
There's a hail, yeah, sorry, that was our...
The hail, the locusts, and then the darkness. Three plagues that come from the sky. And also, the triad follows the rest of the pattern, which is a public warning to Pharaoh, a private warning to Pharaoh, and then no warning to Pharaoh.
Just
okay?
Going to knock you.
You're just going to get knocked out. And then we're going to deal in just a second with the plus one, which is the...
The finale.
The finale, which is going to be the first strike on the firstborns, okay? So the locusts are going to come in, but Moses is kind of going to order the locust strike, and then he's going
It's a point strike. So right. Come in, they're out of there.
And then he says kind of... He prays for a wind to come, and they just go away. That's what I meant
even
by...
Even the pickled ones, by the way.
Even the pickled ones. That's right.
My favorite.
That's right. And they... all these things...
I was hoping to hold on to the pickled locusts.
They might be good. Have you ever eaten a locust?
No, I have not. Have you?
I have not, but I can tell you that I do kind of want to eat the kosher grasshopper one time in my life. I feel like they do have a meal like that.
I know they do.
I've never been to that meal.
I have not gone.
Do you not want to eat like a stir-fried locust one time?
I don't eat meat.
Oh.
I'm not sure which side are locusts parve? We'll have to talk about it later. I bet they are.
You think they're parve, eh?
Yeah,
sure.
Makes sense.
Oh, wow. That's weird.
Think about that one.
Mm. Anyway,
deep fried locust mozzarella sticks.
I think maybe the show should be called the Deep Fried Locust. Hashtag Deep Fried Locust. Right, friends? Deep Fried Locust. That's a great... That's good.
That's a clickbait. Metal band.
That'll do it. Okay, Deep Fried Locust. Anyway, diachronic Deep Fried Locust. Anyway, so there's going to be that. And then there's going to be right afterwards the darkness. The darkness is very thick, 3 days of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And you were telling me off air before that we should contemplate... 3 days of darkness.
I mean, there's a message that the sages derive from this particular plague. You know, later in the story, it's going to speak about Hamushim Alu Min Ha'aretz, that Am Yisrael went out. Likely, the simple reading is armed, right? As in modern Hebrew today, they Hamush armed. But they want to say that the reading is actually 1/5 of Am Yisrael left in terms of Chamesh.
Like 1/5.
Right. And they say it was during the plague of darkness that Am Yisrael died. And four fifths. Why? Because they weren't ready to leave.
Right.
And so even though the text emphasizes the fact that there was light in the houses of the Israelites, it seems to me that there's a message here, and it's at the risk of getting myself in trouble, one that has repeated itself in history, is that at a certain point there are those who see where the bus is headed and those who don't. And those who see where it's headed, despite the fear and the pain and the risk, get on.
Right.
And they move forward in history. 4/5 of Am Yisrael thought they were better off in Egypt. They were sort of blinded by that darkness. And they stayed, and they are no more. I mean, to draw the obvious parallel, most of European Jewry didn't listen to Zev Jabotinsky when he was screaming from the rooftops and every tree he could, get out while you still can.
Maybe also the 10 tribes can be looked at it that way.
Perhaps as well. And then there's a question that I have a question today in terms of all the tension between American Jewry and Israeli Jewry and everyone pointing their finger at each other saying you're going the wrong direction, you're headed for destruction. Well, who's in the darkness and who's in the light there? Who's on the bus headed toward the future? And it's not so obvious to me that there's a resolution in which everybody participates. And it's just a question that I'm holding from a pattern of Jewish history. God has never been about the numbers.
Right.
He's been about the quality.
Right.
And the adherence to plan.
Mm-hmm. Just two descriptive stories, but very short. I'll try to do them very short. One is, I remember this was when I was very active in Aliyah in America, and when I was throwing my Aliyah party for me, it was a J2 pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And when I parked the car, I remember parking the car right behind me, a Satmar Chassid parked the car, and we started talking when we got out. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm making an Aliyah party." I wasn't trying to be like a blue and white. Yeah, not in any way. I'm just telling him honestly. And I even used kind of his lingo, like, I'm going to Eretz Yisrael, you know? So he said to me, the Medina, this and that, the state, it's a problem. I said to him, the Medina is just a keli to bring Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael, to fulfill God's dreams. I said
just
to him, the state is just a vessel to fulfill the great Torah ideals. And then I said to him, I never forget this because I said to him, and there are now 6 million Jews in Eretz Israel. And I could see that that was a, like, that was a
little punch between the eyes.
Right. Because that is like a, okay, that's a, obviously it's a sacred type number in Judaism. And
plus
and
there's just a reality to that, that
right.
at a certain point that just carries its own weight.
Right. What
nothing proof like
again,
success, man.
Again, my favorite Napoleonic quote, right? Quantity has a quality all on its own.
Yes,
right?
That's right. It is for sure true.
Napoleon, he's the best. Anyway, so that's just a great, and that was one quote. And the other quote, the other story I have to tell you is, I told you this a few months ago. I spoke to an ultra-liberal group, the one that, a kind that like makes you say the pronouns.
Their personal pronoun preference.
Yeah, they tell you their personal pronoun preference. Okay, so the guy, you know, and this kid gets up at the end and he says, look, my brother has already left Judaism. And I'm teetering on the edge. And when I hear you talk, all your settler stuff and all that kind of stuff, you're pushing me out. You're pushing me to
jump off the bus.
To jump off the bus and to and you're killing Judaism, because that's what he said. He said, you're killing Judaism because you're pushing me out. I said, the first thing, I'm not pushing you out. I'm here to talk with you. That's why I'm here today. I'm here to address you, to tell you how I'm trying to share with you. That's
it
what I'm.
Sounds like a teenager to me. Anyway.
He was like 19.
Yeah.
You know, like a teenager who here in Israel is already holding a gun and stuff. And second thing, he wasn't asking it in a bratty way. He was really saying what he really, and this is something that I try to tell right-wing people, is when a left-wing person tells you something and he's telling it to you, like, don't just
react.
Be a poo-poo it because you don't like the message. If a guy's actually telling you something, he's also communicating with you. And so honor that.
Yes.
You know, so yesterday I had like Achinoam Nini, this very famous, super left-wing musician, and she came to talk with us. I gave her the kavod. I gave her the honor to have a chat with us, because I honored her commitment to intellectual honesty and to discourse and to dialogue. So he said that to me. He said, look, you're killing Judaism by pushing me away. And I said to him, in other words, I said to him, look, I'm here to share with you my truth. I'm not here to push you away. But secondarily, it's like, look, if you choose to get off the bus, that's your choice. Am Yisrael will keep going.
Yes.
If you're gone,
the bus is not going to stop.
Right. The bus is not stopping.
At this point, if you don't realize that, go back and listen to the rest of the history.
Right. Like, no. Like it's you're out. We're not out. We're not killing Judaism. You might be gone. But that's a good point you're making, which is a painful point,
painful point.
You know, and Jews, even Jews that want off the bus, when you talk to them, they very much don't want off the bus. They struggle very much inside with their identity and these, you know, Jewish like feelings that they have.
Yes.
And they see it, you know, the Bible and the Torah, and then it's their way, whatever it is, and they force the text and they put a whole liberal spin on the text. But at the end, though, they do struggle with Jewish identity.
Yeah, absolutely. They are Jews.
Yeah. But they may not last.
Yeah, well, you know, there was once a well-known demographer who spoke to the faculty here, and he spoke about this phenomenon, what he calls last stop Jews.
Right.
There's people for whom they themselves received something.
Right.
But they didn't receive enough to pass on.
Right.
Not deep enough attachment, not enough knowledge, whatever it is. So they themselves, he called them last stop Jews. And it's a question he had. Just look, what do we do? He's a Jewish survivalist, so he felt like numbers are all that matters. I myself am more of a mission-oriented. So it's not so clear to me. I mean, like, you know, when we look at the assimilation of American Jewry, so for sure, for America, it's good news. It's good news. It's a wonderful group of people that are entering into the mainstream of American culture and contributing at every front on every level. For Am Yisrael, it's not so clear to me that it's good news or bad news. Like, I'm looking for people that are in the mission. I have obviously a fairly clear definition of what I see the mission to be. And I don't think there needs to be any hard feelings. But the problem I see is that a lot of the people who want off the bus, they achieve that by trying to undermine the mission.
Okay, and that's really what we see, which is those that exit off the bus oftentimes become some of Israel's most bitter opponents.
Because of a lot of very old psychological patterns that we know. Right. This is not new, that those who decide to step out become the most fierce critics and often enemies of the people
Ammon
that remain.
Ammon and Moab, they come out of us. Esav comes out of us.
I mean, also, the history of European, you know, Jewry and its relationship to the church. I mean, all the great debates between the church and the Jews were run by apostates.
Right.
This is not a new phenomenon.
Okay. Now, yet again, this is the part that I was laughing at myself. Let's actually enter into a Genesis moment. We had Genesis.
Yes.
Which was the Genesis of things, Bereshit. And then we had the whole the book of Bereshit, which was one kind of flow. Then we had the story of, now we entered into a new book, Shemot, the book of Exodus. Nice name in English, Exodus. Gotta give it. Yeah, it somehow fits a little bit better than the Hebrew name of it. You know.
Well, I mean, let's remember, the sages looked at it as Sefer Geula.
Sefer Geula.
That's the book of redemption.
Okay, fair enough. Great. Well, which is Exodus, right?
Right.
Movement of Japipa.
Hence the soundtrack.
Okay. Right. And then we entered into the story of Moses and his family, and that was a kind of genesis of these
people.
Returns
to that sort of personal familial narrative.
Right. Then last week we had the blueprint overall, what I'm going to do, the beginning of Parshat Vaera, and then back to the strikes, the plagues against Pharaoh. But here we're going to enter into a new modality of the Torah altogether.
Absolutely.
Which is law.
The commanded relationship.
Right. A book of legal, not narrative, of legal, what's the word I'm looking for? Not responsibility of, you assume all kinds of legal
principles and
obligations.
Obligations. That's why I said this,
book of obligations.
This is the beginning of the commanded relationship.
Right.
God says, I'm taking you out. And as we spoke about, I want to embed it into this memory narrative. Like, even as it's happening to now, think about how you're going to tell the story. And now, this is how you're going to embody it in the world. It's not just a story. It's not just what you know or even how you speak. It's who you are.
Right.
And now, through action, you will embody it in the world.
Yeah. Well, before we get to big action, we first have to establish the framework or the ether or the space or the environment of that, which is time.
That's right. Right back to our diachronic.
Right, phenomenon. Diachronic. Right, diachronic. And this is where there's a Genesis moment. I'm going to now give birth to, I'm going to create now the counting of time.
Well, I want to be clear. What I'm going to create is the redemptive counting of time.
Right.
Meaning the solar calendar.
Mission-oriented time.
Mission-oriented time, fine. I mean, the solar calendar exists for all humanity, you know. But it's
cyclical.
It's cyclical and therefore non-goal oriented.
Right.
Right.
Almost frustratingly so, like eternally back
yes,
and forth.
That's what leads to the sort of philosophical pessimism of natural-based religions. We're not going anywhere.
Which is also, we have that in Ecclesiastics and Qohelet, right?
Yeah, sure.
A frustration with
the sunrise, the sunsets, right. And it ain't going nowhere, right? Cyclical time has its power, but it's not so uplifting.
Right.
It doesn't contain a lot of hope. Whereas, I mean, the very word for lunar time is this new division of time that we get in the Torah, which is what?
Chodesh.
Which means?
New.
New.
Right.
Meaning like, you know, the moon's going to disappear, it's going to come back. It's the discontinuous element.
Mm-hmm.
It's the discontinuous mm-hmm. element. Mm-hmm. That allows for linear time. We're going to break that cycle. It's going to have a beginning and an end.
Right.
And even, of course, obviously, in the natural cycle, that itself has its own cyclical element. But it's the punctuation of the very real element of cyclical time with the discontinuous element of the linear purpose-oriented
right.
time.
Right. Another way to draw that is kind of spiral. Or
that's what happens when you combine a circle and a line.
And I used to have one of these watches. Today I don't have it anymore. I had a watch that had a digital readout and an analog readout.
Uh-huh.
And I used to tell people this is the Jewish conception of time. On the one hand, there's a cyclical element.
Going around and around.
Right, which is the holidays and the Sabbath and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, there is a digital time.
From creation to redemption.
Right. Start to stop. Right. Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. So that, but that happens, let's just be clear. I don't think we said it, we verbalized
we didn't say
it, which
explicitly,
is,
right.
Explicitly, which is, Achodesh azeh lechem rosh chodeshim rishon hu lechem lechodshei hashana. This is the first month for you. It's going to be the first month for the months of the year. I'm creating a monthly cycle. This is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Okay, this is the month of redemption. This is the month of kings. This is the month of the chronological time. Starts from here. And you're going to have to, and I'm not only am I creating this thing, I'm telling you to do it. Immediately the Bible becomes very Jewy. What do I mean by that? It's going to be like, well, what do you mean?
Yeah. Well, you love the Rashi here when it says Achodesh Hazeh,
right.
and Rashi supplies you the Midrash conversation. Moshe's like, well, I don't get it. What's the moon supposed
right.
to look like?
What's
the God's like, look right here. And he points with his finger.
Right.
Like
God,
this.
Like this.
And then Rashi's like, but how could he see the moon during the day? He only spoke to me today. He's like, oh, well, it's right at sunset.
Sunset, exactly.
Now, that's exactly when the first sighting of the crescent moon is possible.
Right. Okay.
We live, by the way, in a neighborhood, which, as you know, because you lived there once too.
Yeah.
The sighting of the new moon in our neighborhood is a sight to behold.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It is an incredible, incredible thing.
Absolutely.
We catch it.
Absolutely. You have such a beautiful view out there. It's really breathtaking every time. And that's absolutely right. Okay, you gave me down the law. Immediately, I'm going to ask you for...
We needed explanations.
Right. Immediately, I'm going to make law. So to me, this is such a departure from a non-Jewish or sometimes a Christian kind of perspective on it. It's like immediately get reduced into, okay, God has told you what to do. And I'm immediately like, well, what do you mean by the nitty-gritty of it?
Yes, how are we going to actually do that?
Right, how are we going to do that?
Yes.
Like, tell me exactly how the law is. Oh, you mean, okay, you're going to see it at this time. It's going to be spotted. And then huge tomes are going to be written on these questions about how to sanctify
how,
the new
when,
moon.
When, where, what, yeah.
By the way, they still sanctify the moon in Mecca. They still work that way. For example, when you see, this is what happens when you live in East Jerusalem and you live with Ramadan. So the Arabs will tell you, you say, well, when is the end of Ramadan? They say, well, it's either going to be Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. And we're like, what do you mean? They're like, okay, it's going to be decided.
Wait for the word, right.
It's in Mecca. They have witnesses, and, right. and the whole thing actually goes
really?
Down. Yes.
They've reproduced that entire process.
And by that is they do not go by
a fixed calendar.
For example, in Hebron, we'll have a day where, okay, on the calendar it says that this Sunday is a Muslim holiday, but it gets moot. And that means that, let's say, on this day, the Marat Machpelah turns over all the way to them. Right. And then they a week before.
No, it's actually going
to
be.
They move to Monday. Yeah. It happens.
Cool.
That's the way they do it. Yeah. So that's really cool.
I'm a little bit jealous.
Yeah. Absolutely. And your friend, one of your neighbors, our good friend Yoel Karen.
Yes.
Used to have Rosh Chodesh sighting parties.
Yes, he did.
And that's where I came up with the term that they still use today. Those guys, which is
progressive restorationists.
That's right. Progressive restorationists. That's right. And those were fun parties. Those were fun parties. I wish they would keep going. Rosh Chodesh parties. Rosh Chodesh, by the way, also is Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh, which is new head, new mind, a new way of looking at
things.
Well,
that's why we say, Zman Kapara Lekol Toldotam, mm-hmm. that it's a time of atonement for all your generations, is that one of the great challenges of human psychology is that even when I decide that I want to be a new person, how do I step out of the past? There's a determinism that locks us into this feeling that what was by definition dictates what will be. And so the idea of Rosh Chodesh and what God is saying is like, listen, this is a discontinuity. Here's your chance every month.
Wow.
The moon will disappear and we're going to start fresh.
I guess really if I'm 99% of our listeners, of our just all of us, come on, let's be real. One of our biggest struggles is to be all that we can be, all that we want to be, and to break out of bad eating habits, bad...
I want to sharpen what you're saying. Our struggle is not just to be all we can be. Our struggle is to believe that we deserve to be so knowing who we actually are.
Say that again?
It's not just to be all that we can be. Our struggle is to believe that we deserve to be that knowing who we actually are. Is our judgments on ourselves, which are based often on fact, I know who I've been up to now,
right.
are what prevent us from saying, yeah, but I could be otherwise.
Right.
And so that's the power of Rosh Chodesh.
Okay, but wait. But I think most people, or maybe I'm projecting, but I think most people have a good sense of themselves and they say, I can be this, but inertia locks them in. You're saying most people don't even know who...
No, maybe because of the subset of people that I deal with in my counseling work, but I see that even when people have a vision of who they want to be and a real desire, many people don't believe in themselves because mm-hmm. they know themselves well. And there's a burden of the past.
Right.
We are stuck in that cyclical time fatalism that believes that the past dictates the future. And the entire story of Exodus is not true. There is such a thing as discontinuity in time.
A big believer in that theory was Rabbi Nachman.
Oh,
he was
yes.
a big believer in that theory. And he had one of his concepts is the ability to restart yourself
mm-hmm.
as a real thing.
In every moment, potentially.
Right. But it wasn't just like, okay, it's like a real, like rebirth and restart. I had a funny thing for a while that every time I would go into a tunnel, as I was about to come out, I'm like, this is it. I'm going to be reborn. I'm reborn coming out of this tunnel. I'm coming out of the...
That could be hazardous while you're driving.
No, I'm like, okay. I'm like, okay, we're in the room and we're coming out. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be reborn. But it didn't last. Anyway.
Same on me. See exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Guilty.
Okay, so Chronos, Okay, and I don't mean that in the literary. I know there's
small
there's, yeah, there's like I know that there's
Greek god.
Yeah, there's Greek gods and there's different
Titans and all
no,
that.
No, but they even have different conceptions of times.
Yeah, for sure.
Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. But in any case, I didn't mean it in that way. I just mean to say time. Time, newness, okay? Maybe that's a better word for us. Okay, very good. Next thing is, immediately, which is, Jews of that generation, take for yourselves a goat or a sheep, a one-year kid or a lamb, and bring it into your house. The subtext is, this is the gods of Egypt, and you're going to subdue the gods of Egypt.
You will eat it.
You will end up eating it, okay? And then... you on the 14th in the afternoon, you're going to slaughter it. The 14th of Nisan. There's a date. There's a time. There's a way that it's going to be done. Take from the blood, and put it around your lintels
and doorposts.
And doorposts, which is, I heard now from Rabbi Et Shalom, Rabbi Yitzchak Et Shalom, who quoted Rabbi Amnon Bazak, who discussed how strange this sacrifice is, this korban is. And basically he came out, I'm just shortcutting the whole thing, to say every house becomes a mizbeach.
Yes.
Every house is its own mizbeach. It's its own tabernacle, pronounced correctly, tabernacle. And at the same time, it's also like a womb. Again, kind of the tunnel thing. You're going to come out of this thing. You're going to come out of this entrance. You're going to be reborn as a nation. And it's also a sign for you. The blood is on the inner, supposed to be on the. It wasn't for the Egyptians to see. It was for you to see. And then God is going to skip over the houses of the Jews, and He's going to strike down the Egyptians with the plague of the firstborn.
And on a certain level, all this sets the pattern for all of the commandments. Commandments are largely, not entirely, but largely a sign for you to see.
Right.
Right. It's this inner decision. Of not just like what team you're on, so to speak, but how do you want to make your life? Do you want to live in response to my command in the invitation to relationship that they contain? So that's a sign for you. It's not like, oh, I'm doing this so that people will see me and know I'm a Jew, which is also important. It's an inner sense that are you really part of Am Yisrael?
Right.
Are you willing to put that into action in every way? The way you dress, the way you talk, the way you walk, what you eat, where you go, how you sleep, everything. Right, it's a big ask, and I would say that even people out there who might not see it as the essence of the divine relationship should take very seriously the sense that the wisdom that the Torah hands us down through the generations is that which you embody in the world is that which you believe to be real, mm-hmm. and the rest of it is your thoughts.
It's funny you say embody that which you believe to be real. Another way to embody things, it's gonna be weird. I'm making a connection here, but like a segue. But another way to embody it is to eat that which is not real. It's like you're going to eat their gods again.
Yes.
Again, there's an eating thing.
Mm-hmm. But this goes back to
you're
Noah.
You're disembodying their god.
By the way, this we want to talk about your Genesis moment. This goes back to Noah, mm-hmm. right? One of the understandings of why Noah was the one who was given permission to eat meat, and not Adam. And if you look there in the text, there's a very strong emphasis not only on his permission to eat meat, but on the fact that anyone who spills the blood of a human being, their blood will be spilled, right? Is that the human experience had become so animalistic that they had ceased to see themselves as other than the beasts of the field. So the easiest way to draw the distinction is now they become your food.
Right.
Nobody's going to think that I'm the same thing that I eat. Nor not worry about cannibalism here. So in the same way, what you're pointing out here is that we're going to reduce this thing which you fear. You feared it. You may not have worshipped it as your god, but you know the Egyptians were a powerful culture, and God said, "I'm going to take it all the way down, and it's going to become meat on your table."
Right. That's right. I mean, on a deep level, also on a simple level, it's like you're going to slaughter their gods and consume them.
Yep.
You know, and again, here is Pharaoh's dream.
Right.
Who's consuming who?
Who's eating who, Pharaoh?
Who's eating who? Right. We're eating you. We're eating your guys, and we're becoming fat through it. Meaning to say, you said that the Egyptian.
Keep that metaphorical, please.
Well, no, because we need to remember the Egyptian when Egypt is going to eat you.
Right, there was no sign.
No. There's going to be a fleshly sign. Anyway, okay. And so what ties into it is the new month, ties into the Korban Pesach, ties into matzah, which is what you're supposed to eat with.
Sure.
Ties into. Get ready to go, be dressed
with your staff in hand and shoes on the feet.
Right, which is like, you know, kids, let's go, kids. We're packed up. We're ready to go. Right. Everybody go to the bathroom. Right. We're going on the trip. We're leaving the door. I'm locking the door. Did we forget the electricity?
Last quick bite. Let's go.
Right, we're going. Right, we're going. And I think here is actually the preparatory moment for this generation.
Yes.
We're not commanded. That commandment of being ready to go is not a commandment that we follow.
That we embody in our own practice. That's
but they did.
Yes.
They had to get it that we're going, okay? And then that leads into yet another turn, which is the strike on the plague on the firstborn.
Yes.
Okay. And all of that kind of comes together. And then the firstborns, the Jewish firstborns, are going to be sanctified either because God's presence was there or maybe because of a kind of transference. You know, of the heads of tribes, heads of things, and now you're sanctified in their stead. But anyway, there's a deep progression here that is mixed with seeing time, understanding that you're in a new time and a new month, to
sanctifying action,
right? Sanctifying
this commanded
action.
Relationship,
right?
And understanding that you're on the verge of this massive change, right? Be ready to go. And then the last strike, so to speak. Now, it's important to me just to note, if we're going to speak about the death of the firstborn, that this whole interaction with Pharaoh started with B'nai B'chor Yisrael.
Right.
That when God says to Moshe, you know what the real message to Pharaoh is? Right at the beginning. The real message, you know, they have to say, you know, if you ever have a conversation with someone, the last thing they say is really what they wanted you to know.
Right.
Right? And in the same way, God already sort of like preloaded the firstborn thing, and now here's my last comment to you, Pharaoh. Right?
I think they call that in musical inclusio.
Oh yeah,
like it ends with these terms, man. I used to like these. I like terms. I like French political terms. I like Latin terms.
You got diachronic now.
Yeah. If you feel like sending me a fun term, I love those terms. I think they're fun.
Hashtag term me.
Yeah. Send me a fun. I love political terms. I love the difference between détente and entente. I love these things. I don't know why. I don't know.
Okay, great.
They're fun.
But what
do you
make?
You throw them in sometimes.
Oh, for sure. I am a lover of proper terminology as well. I'm for sure.
And I respect people who can whip out the right word at the right time.
Oh, yes. It's
I love those people.
Yeah, you know my brother. He's very good at that.
Like that, yeah.
He's very good at that. The question here is that if this is the last thing, so to speak, that God says to Pharaoh before they go, what's the message? Mm-hmm. Right? What is this idea of B'nai B'chor Yisrael? Right? Because Egypt, of course, sees itself as the ancient, is the sort of crown and the jewel in the crown of the ancient world. They are the world's first civilization, so to speak. Even though the Mesopotamians could give them a run for the money, but so what's the message here? And the answer, I think, is that once again, when it comes to diachronic, like, you don't become firstborn by being born first.
Mm-hmm.
You become firstborn, says God, by me choosing you. Right? B'nai B'chor Yisrael is not about who was born first. It's about the intimacy of relationship and the sense in the mind of the Creator, as it were, that this is the people who will embody my will in the world.
Right.
Right. And
so I would have, so it's not just about being chosen. It's also about what you just said right now, which is like, yes, you're a leading civilization, but do you want to bring God's message into this world?
But the chosenness, I think, is an important part. And I'm a big fan of not shying away from this question of chosenness, because the reality is I have a firstborn, as do you. You ever find yourself being harder on that child than the other ones?
My firstborn is a girl.
So is mine.
So I find myself to be softer.
Oh, I'm not so soft. Yeah. You can ask her. No, but the point is there's an expectation there, which goes with the privilege and the responsibility.
I didn't mean, by the way, in any sexist way that like girls are somehow to have.
No,
lesser,
it's true. Fathers tend to ride firstborn sons a little bit harder.
Right. Like, and also, you know, I guess she's like a daddy's girl type thing going on.
Yeah. Well, how old is she?
She's 11.
Okay, well, wait till you hit the teenagers. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see.
It's all good. But my point was that is that part of that sort of Bechor status that Am Yisrael has is it's not only, once you're chosen, it's not a choice. Is that you can either fulfill
once
that will.
Once you're chosen, it's not a choice.
Yeah. the you can fulfill my will in the world, says God, Oy vavoy.
Or you could be 4/5.
No, you could be part of this sort of like remnant that will survive and thrive, but you can't get away from that relationship. It doesn't go away.
Right.
You know, they say family is the thing that when you close your eyes, it doesn't go away.
Right? That's an interesting thing you're saying, because I do meet a lot of Jews that struggle with their Jewish identity, where I like sometimes wonder to myself, okay, so you chose to get off the bus, so just relax. Just go be a... Go work. Be a Gentile, and I like mean that in a kind way, which is
chill, enjoy. Yeah, be a healthy, psychologically, emotionally healthy individual and live with your choice.
Who just walked out, and that's okay. You don't have to be part of this peoplehood.
Yeah, but part of the problem with that is that's already a post-Enlightenment conception of peoplehood, which is that you were an individual, you somehow joined the team, you realized, it's not for me, I'm stepping off the team. But the reality is the team predates you as an individual.
Right.
And so therefore, you can step off all you want, but you're still part of the team. Right. And I'm not even going into the anti-Semitic perspective of
I'm not talking about that.
The external.
I'm just talking about the... That could be seen as an assistant.
Oh, yes.
To keep you back in the team. Right.
Historically, it certainly has been.
Right, right.
It's something a little bit more essential.
We have to hurry up a little bit. Because of Mincha, and there's a few other things that I wanted to just talk to you about. First thing is that what we talked about earlier is coming to play right now, which is the Torah is suddenly going to go into a totally different mode, which instead of the moment that we're talking about and the Exodus and all this action, suddenly there's like, okay, let me sit down and talk to you about how I want you to keep it forever and ever. Yeah. I'm going to tell you, I want you to write down law that has nothing to do with your generation per se, or it's little to do with it, or it's memory for your generation. But like, I want you to talk about what it's going to be down the line when there's going to be a temple in Jerusalem. I want you to understand how to remember these days.
And even when you and I are sitting here in the rebuild Jerusalem, or when we're back in Brooklyn or Venezuela or wherever, right? This is the eternal. Remember, we speak about God is outside of time, right? And so there's a wholeness to the divine plan, which depends on our commitment to memory, because memory is what binds past, present, and future together. And so that's why memory is the sacred task of the Jewish people. If you look at how many times we're commanded to remember, right? The sacred task of the Jewish people is to bind together past, present, and future through our actions, teach them to your children, embody them through time, out of belief that God is outside of time. So that the commandment which was is also that which will be.
And this is going to include here's one that I'm not like sure I understand the narrative and then the transference into law, which is don't eat leavened things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly understand why that exact, like I get the Korban Pesach and even the matzah because you told me to eat the matzah then, but there's, and the Torah is going to tell you forever and ever, I want you to not eat leavened food on these 7 days of Pesach.
I mean,
okay, and it's going to tell you on the first day I want you to have a Shabbat type break, and on the seventh day I want you to have a Shabbat type break, and I want you to eat matzah, and I want you not to eat leaven. Then you have to have the Korban Pesach. It's going to lay out the whole Passover holiday.
Yes, and not much has changed since, except the OCD element that modern living has added. I mean, listen, there are many, many things that we could say, and we should probably leave an in-depth discussion of it for Pesach itself. But I think that one thing to carry away from it is that if you really want to get back to that moment of hitchadshut, of renewal that the Exodus offers, there's also return to simplicity. And you know, don't forget that Egypt innovates yeast into the world, beer and bread. And this is the power of humanity to inflate the simple into something complex, which is beautiful and wonderful, and we love it. Mm. But if you really want to get back to that root self and be able to, whether it's attain, you know, atonement or start again or however you think of it, there has to be an absolute simplicity. Flour and water.
It's interesting that's fascinating what you're saying about Egypt, you know, bringing in these complex and the complexities of food and yeastness.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you're saying come back to simplicity with the Exodus, and yet I would counter that, which is like instinctually I would say there is nothing simplistic going to be from here on in. The minute you introduce the law and all the things that we talked about earlier, it's like the opposite of simplicity.
Yeah, we can carry it through, because even though the Torah says you can't offer anything which has leaven on it on the altar, once the one holiday in which we bring unleavened bread close to the altar, Shavuot. We bring the Shtei Alechem,
right,
which are the emblematic offerings of Shavuot. Because as you're pointing out, this is also the building of a new empire, an empire of the spirit, also of the flesh. But it built into that is the need to constantly return to source, this is why the mingling of the solar and lunar calendars is meant to sort of like offer renewal within a sense of sort of a cyclical repetition. There's a lot more in this perhaps than we want to go to, but the shiluv, that integration, is a critical piece of what's happening in this point of the story.
Very good. Very good. Okay, so we have we have integration of simplicity and complexity of the solar calendar, the lunar calendar. We have the eating of the freedom of Exodus, but at the same time the
binding nature of the commandments.
Right, exactly.
Plus past, present, and future.
Plus present.
Right, and what's happened to you now is about a promise I made to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Tell it to your children in the generations to come.
Amazing. That is really, really amazing. The Torah is going to use the word be'etzem. Be'etzem means to the bone. It means, or we would say in English, we'd say it essentially.
Right.
Basically, you would
on
say
on this very day.
Right. So they'll say vehi miketz 30 shana ve'arba me'ot shana. It was at the end of 400 years and 30 years. Vehi be'etzem hayom hazeh, was at the very heart of this day, the very bone, the very
this
essence of this day. Right. Yetzu kol tzivot Hashem. Whoa. All the armies of God left Me'eretz Mitzrayim, the Exodus.
The hosts of the Lord exited, by the way, is the verb.
Exited. Yeah, I guess you're right. It makes sense. That is, the Jewish people are now getting a different name, which is the hosts of God, which is back to the idea that when there is an exile, God goes with us into that exile, and now he's coming back out. And we're going to also talk about taking the bones of Joseph out of Egypt. That's not in this week's parsha. Finally, there is again a refrain about keeping the Passover down the line, and then there's phrases like Torah achat yela izrach ulager hagar betochem. There's going to be one Torah for you, the kind of citizen of Israel, and also the sojourner, the proselyte, the other that is amongst you. You guys, they all have to keep that. By the way, that's interesting. That is actually a, how did you, there's a legal
framework.
You're commanded to do it. You have to, like, as if you're a sojourner in our state.
Yes.
You are bound.
Right. I mean, listen, that might sound, people don't like the idea of the state enforcing the religious law in our world. But don't forget, there's no distinction between so-called religious and civil law in the Torah. So, like, you want the sojourner to look both ways before they cross the street and not drive their car through a red light. So what God is saying is that, well, keeping Pesach is on the same order. It's like, this is the way the world ought to be within my borders. Right. And this, whatever, goes to a much deeper conception of what the polity is here. So let's not go there right now, but it's worth contemplating.
Okay. Finally, there's the issue of the, as you said, you hinted to it, which is the mixture of the solar and the lunar. That also happens in this week's Torah portion because it says, keep this holiday in the springtime.
That's right.
In the spring era. And that means that we have to adjust to make sure, because the lunar calendar is short of the solar calendar, and we have to add a month, many years, out of the years.
This year, I love it. I love having two Adars.
Two Adars. That's right. And here it comes.
If you're going to double any month, what could be better?
Right. You thought that the rabbis, the sages, would have doubled Av. It would have been like
misery twice.
But just so you know, Judaism knows how to party, and we double Adar, double happy months, two happy months for the Jewish people. Great verse that says, "Veshamarta et hachuka zot lemoada miyamim yamima." Keep this law in its time,
from year to year, really.
From year to year, right? From year to year, but it's like it's a beautiful kind of play of words.
Yeah.
And then finally, it says to you, and also put on tefillin.
Yes.
That's how it ends up. Like, I want you now that I've given you the time, the Korban Pesach, the matzah, how to keep it down the line, how to pass it from generation to generation, I want you to bind it upon your arm and your head, between next to your heart and between your eyes in your brain.
So you shall never forget.
So you shall never forget.
Right? And remember that memory is not a passive act of recalling the sort of past into the present, but it's an active stance of recalling the past into the present in order I know what to do for the future. Mm. And that's why it's bound on the arm and between your eyes. You're moving forward here, people.
There's really, and Rashi will tell you, and the first Rashi in the Torah, that you would have thought that this right here is the beginning moment. And that means really it is a beginning moment.
For sure.
It's just the
rest of it's been the backstory.
Right. Right.
For sure.
That's an intense thing. So basically, if you add it all in together, you now have a framework of time, You now have a specific holiday that you have to keep every single year. You have to pass it to your children. And you have to, you know, your diet matters here. You eat other people's gods. And then finally, like, I want you to bind it on your arm and your head and do it for perpetuity. And we're still doing it today. And that's it right. is one of the wackiest, wildest things that we do, and yet so awesome. And
I love
like,
it.
If you want to see, like, and if you want to see a kind of iconic picture of what a Jew is, you'll see a Jew with these bound things to his arms and his head.
That's right. And it's because really that what happens now is the binding relationship begins.
Okay, there was one more topic that I didn't get a chance. There's two more topics that I didn't get a chance to talk to you about Moses himself as a personality, going from revolutionary leader to now lawgiver.
That'll fit next week as well.
That'll fit next week. And also the sons, the study of, like, talk to your sons, tell your sons. They mm-hmm. may ask you tough questions down the line. Torah's preparing us to deal with teenagers.
That's right.
It's
right.
Like,
thank
it's
God.
Like, that's right. It's like you will have a teenager, yes. and you will have to answer these questions. So get ready for that. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer joined us here today. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
So much depth to this Torah portion. It's just staggering. It's really staggering, and it's really accepting a yoke. We're like, today, I could feel, after talking with you now for an hour, that there's a yoke upon us. That yoke is the commandments, but it's also to pass it on properly from Miyamim, from year to year, from generation to generation.
Amen.
All right, folks, stay tuned. Maka Fleischer is next. I know you guys love that segment as well, so stay tuned for that. Rabbi Mike Foyer has an excellent podcast on this, the Land of Israel Network, and also in his whole Rav Micosphere, okay, and that is found at
JewishStory.co,
Facebook.com/Rav Mike, and of course Rav Mike at thelandofisrael.com, myself at YishaiFleischer.com, and of course thelandofisrael.com. Write us an email. I'm Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Somebody sent me an email to forward to Rabbi Mike. No problem. That's easy. Not a problem to handle that. But directly, it's RevMike@thelandofisrael.com. I also want to thank Moshe Herman, Tabitha, and Ben Bresky for doing such a great job of getting this show out to the world. Thank you very much. But stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way. Rabbi Mike, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
All right, guys. Stay tuned. Lots of love. We'll be right back with more. Shalom.
This week on Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston, an exclusive interview with Ambassador Yoram Ettinger.
Israel's control of the Golan Heights is critical for America's interests. And it's time that we, at least in Israel, realize that the U.S. does conduct its affairs based on its own interests, not somebody else's interests.
That's Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston. On the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Judea. And we are joined, therefore, by Malka Fleischer. Malka, shalom and welcome.
Thank you very much. Here I am back again.
On the Land of Israel Network, on the Yishai Fleischer Show, here in Judea, as aforementioned. And it's been raining.
Yes.
But it has not been snowing.
We're slightly cranky. We're also slightly happy. We're more than slightly happy, but we are slightly cranky.
Why is that, Malka?
Because we're very happy about this rain. We need it so badly. I think we talked about it on the last show. My guess is that we've been talking about it on every show since the winter started, because it's like such a central thing. I go check on the Kinneret multiple times a week. Did you know that, Yishai?
No.
I go to enjoy the increases in centimetrage of the Kinneret. The Hermon mountains range up on Israel's north got like what I heard 70 centimeters of snow, but you said you heard 85 centimeters of snow.
Yeah,
that's pretty good, given that all the water that comes from the melted snow from the Hermon ends up oozing down into the Kinneret. So that's good news for us. Also, I've become like very interested in the Kinneret. I guess a lot of Israelis are, because it is not just our like most large body of water in Israel, but it's also one of the main sources of drinking water. And it's a historic thing, and it's our, you know, beautiful little Israel. So you really want to like see the Kinneret doing well. And it turns out that last year, Yishai, during the summertime, some like 125 centimeters of water went down from the wintertime. So basically, and because the Kinneret is
went
like...
Went down from the wintertime?
Like from the end of winter to the next rain, the Kinneret went down 125 centimeters. You basically need about 125 centimeters worth of water to get back to where you started from in the next wintertime. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because of the water use and evaporation and all kinds of stuff that happens.
So over the summer, it goes down 125
Yeah, it goes about 125 centimeters. Right. So that's a meter and 25 centimeters. How much is a meter? Like 3 feet, something like that?
It's about a yard. Yeah.
So, yeah. So basically, with all that snow, this has been a meteorological... This has been a meteorological report from Malka.
Right.
But basically, yeah, we're getting a lot of rain. But the kids every night are giving me sad face because we're getting the rain. But it's like 36 degrees here. And so it's just cold enough to be pretty cold and you need a coat and it's windy, but not cold enough for the snow. And so the kids are really sad. So today I decided that I'm making like deluxe hot cocoa. I used cream. I used chocolate bars, and tiny marshmallows. That is a rare treat. And I loaded them up because I cannot provide the snow, but I can provide the cocoa.
Right. That's right.
So that's my weather slash mothering report.
Were sugarly psyched.
Yeah, they were not happy about the snow. And every night they're like, it's really cold outside. And then I'm like, it's not going to snow. They're like, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to say maybe it will snow. And I'm like, kids, I Googled it. There is also some kind of a fundamental weather war that happens between the people at Google and the Israeli Meteorological Society. Because in Israel, they're like, oh my gosh, people, hunker down. We repeat, hunker down. There's going to be crazy snow. There's going to be crazy water and stuff like that. And you're like, oh no. And Israelis are all nervous. But then you go to Google, they're like, what? We don't know what you're talking about. Everything's fine. Partly cloudy today.
Right. That is very annoying when that
happens. High of 42. And you're just like, I wish the Israelis were right. But, you know, I guess because Israel always has to be prepared for an emergency, we get like a little more intense about all the situations, including the weather situation. So no snow in the forecast. And I seriously, like a child with a tablet, am checking the weather. Children with tablets don't do this, but as a grown up acting like a child, I do this. Checking the weather report like 3 times a day because I also want the snow.
Right.
And I'm just trying to be cool and pretend that my kids are really cute because they want snow. But the truth is that we haven't gotten a good snow in like 4 years.
There's still time, Malka. There's two otters this year.
I'm nervous, I say.
Even though we're in the month of Shvat, which means Tu B'Shvat's coming up, the truth is that there are two otters this year. And as they say, this year Tu B'Shvat is early. And basically, there's still yet time. And it's been a good season. Bezrat Hashem, it'll continue to be a good season.
Yes, amen.
I'm always happy that we have a problem with the Kinneret because it makes me, it makes nobody overly reliant on desalinization, all that business. Malka, but you do have some good news for us today, do you not?
I have all kinds of good news for us today.
Let's hear some good news.
Okay, first good news of the day is that maybe you guys will remember back to exactly 1 month ago when Shira Ishran and her husband Amichai were standing at a bus stop with some other people outside of Ofra, which is very near to Beit El, where we used to live. I guess you would call it Southern Samaria, the Benjamin tribal area. And a white car slowed down and basically mowed down the people at the bus stop, showering them with bullets. 7 people were injured, including Shira Ishran, who was 7 months pregnant with her first child at the time. She was evacuated to Shari Tzedek Medical Center in critical condition. Mm-hmm. And basically they were not sure that she was going to make it. She had lost a lot of blood and being pregnant. They gave her an emergency C-section to try to save the baby. In the first day, Shira looked pretty bad and her baby was doing okay. Her husband was taken to a different hospital. He was also injured in his leg, Amichai. But over the course of the next several days, Shira's condition improved. Amichai was already stable. I mean, he had a bad leg wound, but he was already stable. But their baby took a turn for the worse. And very sadly, despite all the efforts of the doctors and really, truly tens of thousands of psalms and prayers from around the world, the little baby who was born too early and in such difficult conditions passed away.
Right
after his parents had the merit to meet him, basically, for the first time. A ritual circumcision was performed on him, and he was named Amiyad Israel, my eternal nation Israel. And he was buried on the Mount of Olives, near where we used to live, in the historic ancient cemetery of the Mount of Olives.
Right.
And Shira and Amichai were not able to attend that burial because they were so badly injured and in the hospital. Shira, over the course of time, improved and improved and improved. And it is my great pleasure today, Yishai, to tell you that exactly 1 month after she was injured so critically in that terror attack, she went out of the hospital, basically. She was released from Shari Tzedek. This is a great thing. They did a little press conference when they left the hospital, and Shira basically told reporters, we are a walking miracle, she said about herself and her husband. I got to the hospital lying down and left walking. She thanked everybody for praying and asked people to keep praying for her. She thanked the hospital staff, and she thanked God for saving her, basically. Happens to be, Yishai, and we mentioned it way back when, but I'll mention it again now, that we knew Shira, not so well, but we know her parents, Chaim and Leora Silberstein, who lived with us in Beit El, and her father, Chaim, is very, very active in the effort to liberate properties in Jerusalem for the Jewish people. And
to teach about Jerusalem, kind of integrity, and that we shouldn't divide it. That's what his organization is, Keep Jerusalem. So he's not just about property buying, but he does a lot of education.
Right, educating people as to the Jewish connection to Jerusalem.
Yeah, and the importance of not dividing it. That's the main thing. He actually is the one who first taught me about East Jerusalem. He's the one who took me to East Jerusalem for the first time and showed me what it's really about. So that's who Chaim really is. He takes like politicians and important leaders to different like hills overlooking Jerusalem, and he explains the importance of it to having integrity and kind of unity.
Right.
So that's what, and check it out. I think it's keepjerusalem.org. That's Chaim Silverstein. He's a South African.
Right.
Okay, South African.
And he's a great person.
Great
and this
guy.
Thing that happened to them was so outrageous. And, you know, this was their first grandchild, Yishai.
Right.
And they lost their first grandchild. And it was very, very heartbreaking and very difficult. But I think certainly they're overjoyed that their daughter is doing so much better. She had... they're very modest type people, and they keep to themselves in a sense, even though Chaim is very active in the fight for Jerusalem.
Right.
In his nature, he's like a private family man. So he didn't necessarily go public with so many of the details, but I heard some bits and pieces because I made contact with him after what happened with Shira. We hadn't been in contact with him for a while, but when something like this happens, I think it's important to
reconnect.
To connect and show support and just do whatever you can, you know.
Right.
It's not the time to be distant. It's not the time to be so formal, you know. So I reached out to him, and he told me that his daughter had some like exit wound, skin grafts, and all kinds of stuff. Like, it's complicated. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
She had some injuries to her leg that they were concerned may cause, you know, permanent nerve damage and affect the way that she walks. If you'll see videos from her exit of the hospital, you see that she's using a walker. Right. And her husband was on crutches. I mean, they're quite a pair, the two of them.
That's what happens when you get both shot.
Right, but they look good in a sense also. Yeah. You know, she looked good. Her hair was done up in a nice mitpachat, a nice scarf. Anyway, so when I made touch with Chaim, after it was already many, many days after she had been hurt, and I asked them if they had set up any kind of fundraising campaign, because that's... we shouldn't even know from it, right? But it's like a kind of a common thing to try to raise money for people in times of difficulty like that. So we set up a fundraiser on Mighty Cause. It's a website called mightycause.com. You can look for Shira and Amichai Ishran. Just type that in. You can look for them and you can donate money to them. And so far, the campaign has raised over $35,000.
That's amazing.
Which is very, very good. I don't think it's going to cover all their needs, meaning to say that there's going to be a lot that they need in the near future and in the long term, in the long haul, to get them through. But I was glad to be even the teensiest little part to help them set up this Mighty Cause fundraiser.
Very good.
And it's good to see today that exactly 1 month from the attack, you know, she walked out on her own two feet.
Right. But the baby didn't.
But the baby did not.
No.
The baby did not. But I have to tell you that after he passed away and after she got the strength back to address the public, mm-hmm. She and her husband made a different press conference in Shaare Tzedek Medical Center. And she basically, they came out with messages of strength and said that their son, Amiyad Yisrael, my eternal nation Israel, had managed to unite the Jewish people, and you know, so many prayers went out for them. Even though he didn't make it, I think that they felt that their baby did something in this world. And I think that, and she said, you know, I plan to have many more children, basically, and you're not going to stop us. And I thought that was a very brave thing to say. Yep. And a very inspiring thing.
Very good. Very good, Malka. So there's rain and there is life. And we continue to live here in the land of Israel and certainly in Judea and Samaria, and to be watered by the blessings of God. What else you got?
Well,
and of course, we also don't have snow, but we have hot cocoa.
Yeah, we got the hot cocoa. And if Israel has its way, we also may have a whole lot more money in our coffers here in the land of Israel to the tune of about $250 billion. And this is an interesting story. I wonder where this is all going to go. It turns out that Israel hired an international accountancy firm to tally how much value could be ascribed to all the properties, money, and lands, all the jewels, all the everything, businesses that Jews who had to flee Arab countries after the Declaration of Independence of Israel, how much they had to abandon. And now Israel is going to be going after those countries for compensation.
We're talking about 800,000 Jews who were kicked out of Arab countries?
Over 850,000 Jews. Mm-hmm. They're saying 856,000 Jews, according to an organization called Justice for Jews from Arab Countries. Mm-hmm. And they want restitution.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing this in stages, it looks like. So far, they have finalized their demands for two countries, Tunisia and Libya. They want $35 billion from Tunisia and $15 billion from Libya. You can do a little math and figure out how much is left for Morocco, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Yemen, and Iran. I can only imagine us trying to collect money from Iran, but nonetheless. Under Israeli Minister for Social Equality, Gila Gamliel, who is coordinating these compensation suits, she said, "The time has come to correct the historic injustice of the pogroms against Jews in seven Arab countries and Iran, and to restore to hundreds of thousands of Jews who lost their property what is rightfully theirs.
Yeah, look, if you have compensation from Nazi Germany, we're talking about the same time period. We're talking about around the same time.
Right. And it's not like we're not talking like you and I, Yishai, we love Aliyah. We're Zionists. We believe actively in the return of the Jewish people on their own free volition to come back to the land of Israel as an ideological value. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about Jews who are like, you know what? I love Israel so much. I'm just going to, wow, we have independence. I'm just going to get up and I'm going. No. What we're talking about is countries that were like, oh, you Jews want to Jew it up here in the Middle East with your Jew country? You Jews go to your Jew country. Get out of here.
And let us keep all your property.
Yeah, and you can take a suitcase, maybe.
Right.
Or you have 20, or you have, you know, you have a week to like settle your accounts, right? Like you're leaving here in a week. Get out of here. Or we're going to kill you if you don't go. Things right. like that, right? Then, not and, a nice
and then,
aliyah.
And then it's not like
not
you're selling
nefesh
your house
benefesh.
For right, you're not selling your house for
right.
cost.
Right. It's like if you sold your house at all, it was like for pennies on the dollar to the neighbor who was pretty excited to get a good deal from you that you lived next to him for 50 years, right? So we're talking about real, genuine compensation for things that were lost. One thing I learned over the course of learning about this little venture, this little Israeli venture.
And you write for JNS?
I write for JNS, Jewish News Syndicate. So I got
JNS.org.
JNS.org, and I got the chance to kind of learn about this. It turns out, I did not know this, that there is a 2010 Israeli law that says that if Israel makes any kind of peace deal with the Palestinians, it must include compensation for Jewish-owned assets stolen or abandoned by Jews who were forced to flee their homes in Arab countries and Iran. Didn't know that, right? That's an interesting little fact. Happens to be, Shai, I don't know if it's in direct relationship to this story, but the Palestinian Authority organization is also claiming that it is owed restitution from Israel for all the what they say is was stolen and abandoned, and they're asking for $100 billion. I wonder about all this. I wonder what the numbers are on that. Israel has not crunched those numbers as far as I'm aware, or they certainly have not publicized if there's any compensation owed.
Were you the one who retweeted the Mark Halawa tweet? Mark Halawa is this this Arab who found out that he was actually
Jewish,
a Jew, and he is now lives in Israel and basically grew up with systemized Jew hatred, and today exposing that. And one of the I saw that somewhere, and he tweeted out saying something to the effect of, "That's they're not refugees. We were told leave. They were told leave." The Palestinian, leave this area so that we could kill the Jews, and then you'll come in and you'll take all their houses and stuff like that. So it's not refugees in the classic sense that like you were running away from the Israeli aggression and all that. Actually, you ran away because the Arabs told you to run away, and then
the Palestinians ran away because the Arabs told them to run away.
Yes, because the Arab leadership said
we're
to
like
them,
get out of there.
Get out. We're going to come in with our armies and destroy everything.
And
then
you'll come
have,
back and take your house back.
Right.
That's interesting.
And take the neighbor's house back also.
Right.
So he's like, it's a totally different situation.
It is a totally different situation. But you know, it's interesting, Yishai. Look, were there any Arabs who owned houses in Israel prior to 1948?
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. And there's a part of me that thinks that there should be a compensation package. That instead of doing all of this negotiation over who's going to own what, I think there should be a compensation. I think that Israel should say, look, you did this family. We have records. This family did own a house. Here's money. We're not going to be giving you back this house, but you deserve.
Right.
You deserve and you are entitled to. You have the right to the value of that home.
Right.
And here it is. Mm-hmm. And that to me sounds legitimate. I think that Israel should employ another international or same international accountancy company to find out like what, let's get real here. How much is owed? Is there something owed? I'm not here to say, you know, I have strong belief that the Jewish people are, you know, destined to live in the land of Israel and that they belong with the land of Israel. But are there some accounts that need to be settled? There might be. And I say, let's do it.
Very good point, Malka. I appreciate that point very much. I think that's a great point. Speaking of settling accounts, I got to hang out this week with Ahinoam Nini, who is a very famous Israeli singer. She sings a very famous song called Bowie Kala, right? Everybody knows that one. Bowie Kala.
Go on, go on.
No, I'm going to ask Ben Bresky to
oh, maybe I'll stick in a little bit.
To stick it in a little bit here at the end of the show. But Ahinoam Nini is also well, she doesn't like it when I tried very hard on Twitter to explain what she is. Is she a hard left? Is she a pro-Palestine activist? Is she a post-Zionist? Is she pro-BDS, like some reported?
What does she say? What are some of her like?
Well, I didn't get to hear her say. She says all, you know, she basically thinks that we're occupying somebody else's land and that we...
she's against Jews living in Judea and Samaria.
Right, and she definitely thinks that for peace we should get out of there and that we're violent and we're extreme and this and that and that the... I actually didn't hear her say anything herself when we were at the meeting. She was more listening, and there were other people talking there. But in any case, she came in.
Listening is good.
Yeah, she came into dialogue, and I said to her, "I'm impressed with the fact that you came into dialogue." And she basically was like, "I'm impressed with you guys that you're interested in dialogue."
Great.
And it was like also like nobody was going to change their mind. We were just going to hear each other a little bit more.
Okay.
And that was kind of fun, and that was kind of cool. Again, she uses her international platform to, in many ways, besmirch the name of Israel. She recently called Trump a Hitler, and et cetera. She used a lot of pretty vociferous language. Right now, her ire is on Trump and not on Israel. But in any case, she showed herself to be like a kind of cool person trying to communicate.
She showed up. I'm not saying that means you have to have a radically different view of her than you did before, but I respect a person who can come and sit down and listen.
That's right.
Because a lot of people cannot do that.
Anything else on your plate, Malka?
I just have this light, happy story. Maybe to tie it all up.
Let's do it.
It's like a random and happy little random story.
All right.
And here it is.
Yeah.
A Haredi, that means ultra-Orthodox, mother of five children from Jerusalem, won the Tveria Marathon. The first ultra-Orthodox woman to take first prize in that event, and maybe in any Israeli marathon ever. Her name is Bracha Deutsch. Her friends call her Speedy Beedy. And she finished the Tveria Marathon in 2 hours, 42 minutes, and 18 seconds.
Dang.
The fifth fastest time for a female Israeli marathon runner. The event was attended by her husband, who is a yeshiva teacher, and her kids. She and her family made Aliyah 8 years ago, and she was not even anticipated to win the race. There was another lady named Elena Dolanin who was anticipated to win, but she had some kind of ankle injury or something like that. Something happened with her.
Yeah.
And if she had run this race with this time in 2016, she would have qualified for the Olympic Games.
Right.
Bracha Speedy Beedy Deutsch.
But I don't know if she wants to be in the Olympic
However,
Games. Yeah.
She does.
Oh.
She does. The 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo have an entry requirement of 2 hours and 36 minutes, which means that she was like 6 minutes and 18 seconds over making Olympic time. One thing that's cool about this lady also is that she only started training 3 years ago.
No.
Yeah. So she's actually all the way into it now. She like trains with some running people and stuff like that. And she says, I think my dream of becoming the first female ultra-Orthodox Olympic champion might be possible. And you see pictures of her online wearing a tichel, one of these like little scarfy tie things, a long sleeve shirt and a black skirt and running shoes. She looks like any mom who like jogs down the street, except if you look closely at her, you see she has like big calves, you know, from all the running.
But I wouldn't look.
No, you wouldn't look. That's
I wouldn't
okay.
look. Don't look.
And here's something nice that she says.
It's Nias.
She says, Elena Dolanin, Israel's former record holder, was considered the safe bet. When I passed her during the race, she wished me luck and congratulated me.
Wow.
Isn't that sportsmanlike? Boy, 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 boy.
Sheesh.
She says throughout...
And she also passed me an amazing challenge recipe.
Yeah. Bracha said, throughout the race, I had great confidence in my abilities since God guided me every step of the way.
Ding.
She is trying to do a Kiddush Hashem. And I say, go, girl. Go, Speedy Beedy. Any girl who wants to do a Kiddush Hashem should do it any way that she
wants. I like her more Hebe name.
Bracha Deutsch?
Yeah, Bracha Deutsch. Bracha Deutsch.
I wish she was named Brachi Deutsch. That
I wish she was Brachi Shani Deutsch.
Anyway, she's very, very cute. And she's from New Jersey.
Of course.
And she's like a running superstar. And the event was on Friday.
Uh-huh.
So she's like, smile for the camera, smile for the camera, smile. I got to go home. I got to go make Shabbos.
No, not make Shabbos. She already made Shabbos. She made it early this week.
You know, take a shower and get the kids in their clothes.
But I'm saying she already made Shabbos.
Probably. But, you know, you got to turn the cholent pot on.
I'm saying. The little, the last thing. Yeah, she made it. She made it Wednesday night. I stayed up all night.
Anyway, that's a little cute.
I can't wait to hear. That's all. That's a great story, Maka. Thank you very much, Maka. You made it look like everything is just hunky dory. Like news. Well, no, I'm saying like this week I've been listening to the news and it was all just, I don't know, gobbledygook. No, don't.
My favorite John Bolton, not to be confused with Michael Bolton, as I have previously done on this show personally.
Okay. What about John Bolton?
He was in Israel this week. We could go on for hours.
Yeah.
On this show right
now. He was snubbed by Erdogan. Erdogan did not meet with John Bolton.
I didn't know that. I didn't follow him once he left Israel.
Yeah, he got snubbed.
Well, whatever.
He got snubbed.
Is what I got to say.
Which is weird because Erdogan wrote a pro U.S. article in the New York Times like 3 days beforehand.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I think he was cranky because Bolton went with Netanyahu or was supposed to go with Netanyahu to the Golan Heights.
Yeah.
And basically, Netanyahu is pushing hard now for the United States to recognize. I mean, let's do a parenthesis here for a second. I like when the United States recognizes everything, but I think we need to just go ahead and say that I think our primary concern needs to be the annexation of lands and not necessarily the U.S. recognition.
The Golan is annexed. It's annexed land. 1982 law.
So Israel is asking the United States, just like it formally recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, it wants the United States to formally recognize the Golan Heights as part of Israel.
Yeah.
And I also want that because of the snow that we were talking about before.
That's right,
and
there.
And for many other reasons.
Including Mount Hermon.
I'm hoping that we'll take the children
to
the Hermon again because, like I said, it's been 5 years. If it doesn't snow this year somewhere where we're living, it will have been five years.
But it has been snowing nicely on the
Hermon. And insanely enough, they will let you take your children on the ski gondola up the Hermon. And the reason I know that is because I've done that.
That's right.
And we took our baby Israel, who is a total nutball, God bless him, Hashem Yishmor Oto Ad Me'ev Esrim.
Amen.
And he's like a ball of energy, and he kicked off a shoe.
Yes.
On the gondola.
I saw it fall down.
He was two, I think, or one and a half, something like that. Yeah. He was very little. And he kicked off a shoe into the snow. And when we finally made it to the top, which is terrifying, by the way.
Yes.
It's not like there's seatbelts. It's a regular ski gondola. Honestly, it's totally crazy that they let us up there with our kids. And it's crazy that we did it, but we did it.
Yes.
And we just did it. And then we got up there and our kid only had one shoe. And so I had to...
makeshift.
Be Israeli, right? Which is like MacGyver it up. So I looked around. I went into the garbages, not overly, right? I didn't get like icky stuff on my hands. But I went into the garbages and I found a Bamba bag.
That's right.
Peanut snack.
Right.
Which is the most Israeli thing that there is. And I used my daughter's hair tie to tie the Bamba peanut snack bag onto the child's foot so that he could do... like, you know, 30-second bursts of walking around in the snow without getting a sock wet.
That's right.
I'm Israeli.
What did we call him? Captain...
Captain Bamba or something like that.
Captain Bamba pants or something like that.
And we have pictures from that blessed event.
That was awesome. All right, we got to get up there
to buy
the
new shoes.
Anyway, Malka, I like your take on the news. Thank you so much for leaving us with good energy and good cheer in this new secular year. This new solar year, I want to thank you very much, Malka.
Wait, is this our first show? No, it's not our first show since the new year.
Whatever. In any case...
Happy 2019, everybody.
Yeah, let's make 2019, you know, a great year and a great financial year. right? That's like the way to count finances is by the secular year. So
okay.
I bless everybody with a great financial year as well. I want to bless you all with great health, great happiness, great Parshat Bo. Malcolm, I'm very excited for Bo this year. Like Bo Diddley, like Bo and Arrow, like Bo Henna. Like come here, like Bo, man. This Torah portion is all about Exodus and the new month and teaching our children about Passover. We talked extensively about it on the last half. I'm very excited for the Shabbos. There's a lot of Midrashim that I want to catch up. There's more Torah that I want to learn before Shabbat comes. Okay, and so I'm excited about that. I'm excited for Shabbat in Eretz Yisrael with all of you out there. And we're going to go see my good friend David. We're going to go see my mom. I'm excited for that very much. And I'm excited to be in your life. So if you finished off this show, please do hashtag Captain Bamba. That's right. hashtag Captain Bamba. That means that you finished to the end of the show. Thank you very much. Remember, for this week, I'm asking you for great terminology. I'm asking for like Latin or French political terms or great political terms that Isha enjoys. Okay, that's the present hashtag that you could send me. I appreciate that very much. And I want to thank our sponsors, the Israel Bible. Okay, theisraelbible.com. It's an amazing Bible focused on the land of Israel at theisraelbible.com, edited by my friend Rabbi Tuli Weiss. Tchelet, that's the blue string that has been reborn, resurrected. And now going to be on your clothes, on your son's clothes, and it's a very special opportunity. And you could learn about the incredible commandment of Tchelet and how they got to it at T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, Tchelet.com. I want to thank the good folks at the Hebron Fund. Hebron Fund is an incredible organization that helps you get to the tombs of the fathers and mothers in Hebron. So go to the HebronFund.org, and I'm honored to work in the Jewish community of Hebron in order to keep the tombs of the mamas and the papas and a brave community around it safe and strong. I want to thank the Land of Israel Network for the host of the show. I want to thank the good folks that make it happen, including Moshe Herman, Tabitha, and Ben Bresky. Thank you so much for all that you do. And I want to thank our listeners and our donors and our friends and our colleagues. And I want to really, really thank you for making everything possible. Without you, it wouldn't be possible. So thank you. And I want to thank God Almighty for giving me a beloved wife. Thank you, God, for my beloved Malka and for the children and for the life here and for being able to broadcast to you from Judea, from the land of Israel, right here, overlooking Jerusalem, halfway to Hebron, overlooking the Mediterranean and with the Dead Sea to our backs, and on these cold nights here in Judea. We are so, so lucky to be alive. So I just want to thank you folks very much for being with me. God bless you, Maka. I want to thank you also, especially, Maka. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
God bless you, folks. Stay strong. Stay tuned. Stay connected. Be part of the story wherever you are. Wherever you are, you're a part of it. Don't let anything get you down. Don't get depressed. Don't let anything tell you that you're not doing what you're supposed to do. You could be prepared right now for an amazing tikkun, amazing fixing of your soul, and being part of a great, great story. God's great story, His great story, His great will to bring the Jewish people back to the land of Israel so that there'll be a great light that comes out to the whole world. You're going to be reflecting it. You're going to be sharing it. You're going to be lighting that menorah. Stay tuned, and God bless you. Shalom. Hugs and kisses from Jerusalem and Yehuda and all the land of Israel. Shabbat shalom.
You know, there are people who like to do what they're told, and there are people who like to tell others what to do. And then there are people out there who are just wondering what exactly needs to be done. Which one are you? I'm Rav Mike Poyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Listen to The Jewish Story with Rav Mike Poyer on thelandofisrael.com.